Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nachtigall, the host of the program. I'm here in Edmond, Oklahoma, where we have our exhibit, The Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered, which is here on display for another couple of months. And I'll be talking to Christopher Reams from our office in Jerusalem. And we're going to go through our top 10 finds from the world of biblical archaeology for 2024. This is something we really enjoy doing every single year. If you do like this program, don't forget to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel to make sure you don't miss any of our great content. But we're going to cut right to it here with our top 10 with Chris. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming in from Jerusalem.
Hello, Brent. It's a pleasure. It's that time of year again. Crazy.
Yeah, we're actually earlier this year than last year. We are only a couple of days after the turn of the year to go through our top 10 of finds in biblical archaeology. And as we do usually, I'll do a couple or one or two, you'll do a couple, and we'll work our way from number 10 all the way down to number one. And again, as far as criteria goes, these are finds for biblical archaeology. So these are discoveries that were made in the lands during the periods of the Bible. And also they might be studies, maybe not a new discovery itself, but perhaps a new study on an older discovery as we go through. So you're going to start us off with number 10, and then I'll be with number 9. So number 10, Chris.
Sure. With number 10, we start off with the hallucinogens. This was a discovery that came out of Tel Es Safi, or Gath. This was a Bar-Ilan University research paper. And basically what they did was they took plant matter from two Philistine temples that were found at this site, one of them dating to the 10th century and another to the 9th century BC. And both of them destroyed during the late 9th century BC. So really early Philistine temples, and they found some plant residue remains in these temples and studied them and found them to be hallucinogenic and having evidently served some kind of a ritual function in these Philistine temples. So for example, one plant or plant matter was from the chaste tree, which is a known hallucinogen and it's an aphrodisiac and an anesthetic. And the other plant object that they found was poison darnel, which that one is a hallucinogenic fungi, which contains LSD alkaloids. So you can get a sense of the kind of ritual stuff going on in the Philistine temple cult. And while the Bible doesn't talk directly about hallucinating Philistine priests, there is a potential link in Isaiah 2, verse 6. It talks about the Philistine soothsayers and denounces these soothsayers. And the word soothsayers is ananim in Hebrew, which, you know, Hebrew, that's the word for clouds, and it's this link to clouds. And so perhaps there is some kind of etymological link between the two in the sense of soothsaying and perhaps getting to that state through inhaling these kinds of substances in Philistine temples such as this.
And being in the clouds while you do it.
And in the clouds.
Yeah, some things don't change over thousands of years, if that's the terminology to describe it. Thank you for number 10. I'm going to do number 9. This is patriarchal period dyes. Were found on a piece of textile. This is in the famous Cave of Skulls that's in the Judean desert, Judean wilderness. This cave has brought out other discoveries, but this one is a textile that dates all the way back 3,800 years. It was carbon dated to that time period, and it has a beautiful reddish color to it. This was a study that was put out by the Antiquities Authority, Bar-Ilan University, and Hebrew University. And this is the earliest evidence of a red dyed textile. Now, people that read the Bible will be very familiar with the scarlet color being used in the English to describe this type of dye that came from actually a crushed insect. You can produce a red dye through using plant woad, I think it is. But when it's made out of the insect, it's far more vibrant and long lasting. And so you have a couple of instances in the Bible that actually date to the period from when this was found 3,800 years ago. You have, this is the patriarchal period. In particular, there's the example in Genesis, I think it's chapter 38. It mentions the two sons, the twins of Judah, the original patriarch of the tribe of Judah, having two sons, Peretz or Phares and Zara. And Zara, apparently, its hand came first from the womb, and there was a scarlet thread that was placed around the hand. And then Peretz or Phares came out, and this Phares is the breech, which came out first instead of Zara. And it's a scarlet thread. And so they obviously knew how to dye textiles anciently. And what's very specific about this one, though, that was found is that it was a textile or made from an insect that isn't native or not even found in the land of Israel. It's actually an insect created this dye that came from more the Western Mediterranean, parts of the Western Mediterranean. So it proves that there was a lot of trade going on with these ancient dyes going back almost 4,000 years as well. And so just fascinating that these things can be discovered, and it takes this really dry, arid climate for such textiles to be preserved. And we have some textiles here in our exhibit in Oklahoma. These date to around David and Solomon's time, 3,000 years ago. This textile, this little patch, goes all the way back 800 years even before then.
Okay, number eight. This is the earliest deep sea shipwreck ever discovered. This was announced in June. And this is a 3,300 year, roughly, year old shipwreck that was found 90 kilometers off Israel's coast. So this is in the deep sea. This is sailing without a line of sight to the coast, as it were. So this is pointing to early mariners' ability to be able to sail some of these longer distances over deep seas. And this shipwreck was found full of hundreds of amphorae. Only a couple of examples have so far been pulled up from the wreckage. The ship itself is a vessel about 13 meters long. So there's a lot more investigating to do. At this stage, we only have the briefest glimpse of pictures of the ship lying on the seabed. It's remarkably well preserved, given that it's been down there 3,300 years. And only a few of these amphorae have been pulled up, and they need to be properly investigated. But what we do see is some of the same things you were mentioning with our number nine discovery, some of this trade going on across the Mediterranean, across seas where you don't have a line of sight necessarily to land, across deep seas, pointing to the abilities of early mariners. And this is something we can take for granted, but like some of the reports said in the June announcement, some of these researchers were calling this a history-changing discovery, really the earliest ship ever found in the deep sea. So that takes place, that takes our number eight spot in the list.
All right, number seven. This is one that's only just been published in the Israel Exploration Journal. And we have an article about this on the ABA website that was written by you. And this is the analysis by Professor Michael Langlois that the Tel Dan Stele, the House of David inscription, has been incorrectly reassembled. And this was here actually as of a month ago. It's currently right now in New York City, the Tel Dan Stele, and it's going to go back to Israel, I think, in a week. It's meant to go back to the Israel Museum. And what was so interesting and fascinating about this is Professor Langlois, who's an epigrapher, he was called in to renew a study of this artifact, or do a presentation about this artifact, and he wanted to present something new. And so he reanalyzed all the letters, and perhaps he could find a new translation of it, because there's some wiggle room, because what you have is one big fragment on one side that was found in 1993 in Tel Dan, and then two other fragments that go together but were found separated in 1994. And these were attached back in the day in early 94, And what he realized when he's studying the letters is that there is variance between four or five of the letters and how the scribes actually wrote those letters on fragment A and the fragment B1 and B2 that were next to it. I think it's the Resh, maybe, I think the Bet, the Kaf, and then the Lamed, if I'm not mistaken. And it shows that the scribe, when he's writing them, some of them, instead of having one stroke, which they would on one fragment, they had two strokes to make the same letter or part of the letter. And so it clearly showed that a scribe isn't doing this anciently. He's not writing part of it on one line using one method of writing a letter, and then further on the same line, changing that method to write that same letter. And then all of the letters on that, or all the those letters on one, those two fragments being different as far as those four characters are concerned. So this is so fascinating. It doesn't impact at all the House of David part of it. It still says House of David. That's all on fragment A. But what it does show us is that there is a different layout. The fragment B1 and B2 either belong above or below, and that what you might have had is a different scribe being brought on to do the next half of the inscription, if you like, or perhaps he got a little bit tired and decided to loosen up a little bit as he got towards the end of the inscription. We're not sure exactly how it happened, but it's definitely indicating that the way that it's been put back together right now is incorrect. And it needs to be busted up at some point. Although now it tells a historic, this it's a story in itself. There's history attached to the way it's attached. So maybe they'll leave it, I'm not sure. But congratulations to Professor Langlois. He came on the program to discuss this a while ago. But now we have the official paper about it. And it shows just how much can still come out about discoveries that have been studied over and over and over again, particularly as new technology comes out. There was different imagery that he could do with this inscription that they could do actually at the Israel Museum, because they took it out of the cabinet because it was coming here, and they captured that moment to do some extra work on it. They did also do some archaeomagnetism to two different fragments of the basalt inscription. This showed that the two parts of it are definitely from the same inscription and from the same face of the stone as well. So we know they belong together, but just not the way that they are currently reconstructed.
Yeah, and if our listeners are able to get a hold of the IEJ article, I'd encourage you to do so, because if you see that comparison, that visual comparison between each of these letters, the ones on the B side of the fragment and the A side, it's like the two B fragments, B1 and B2, the letters are identical to one another. But then in every case, they're different on the other side. So it's like consistency with these two fragments, which definitely go together, but then that variation. So really a remarkable discovery by Langlois. Number six on our list, the MMST or Memshet discovery. This was by another epigrapher, our good friend Dr. Daniel Weinstub. And this takes a little bit of explaining. Maybe I can use a pottery handle here as an example. This isn't a Lamellic handle, but basically what the Lamellic seals are stamped handles of vessels from the late 8th century BCE. And Lamellic means to the king, and this was some kind of taxation or preparation effort, generally described as being done in advance of of Sennacherib's Assyrian invasion. So there are generally four different types of inscriptions on these handle seals. What you'll have is Hebron or Ziph or Shoko or Memshet. So the first three, Hebron, Ziph, Shoko, these are all known, well-known biblical cities, archaeological cities, but Memshet, MMST, has always been a puzzle. Ever since the first example with MMST written on it, Memshin Taf, was discovered in 1868. That's 156 years ago. What does this word mean? I mean, the others are cities, so surely this is a city. But we don't know it from the Bible. We don't know it from archaeology, from the history of the time period. We do have somewhat of a similar sounding city, but that's from later on during the Hellenistic period onwards. So what could this word mean? Well, this year, Dr. Weinstub produced a new paper basically showing that this cannot be a proper noun. This cannot be a place name, even a personal name, like based on the rules of Semitic languages. And he goes through the whole gamut of different Semitic languages and the inherent rules baked into them. For this word to work, it cannot have a root of mem mem shin or start with the dual letters mem mem. Like he gives several examples of this and shows that this cannot be referring to a Judean city. So instead, he proposes that this is a phrase reading from the maset or min maset. So basically, this is an abbreviation to describe a very specific type of tax or collection being done at the time of Hezekiah. And you have a sense of this, actually, this kind of a tax or maset collection being done in the Book of Chronicles, discusses it. I forget the chapter now, but it talks about Hezekiah collecting some of these things into the temple compound as part of this tax. Do you remember, Brent, what that passage was? Second Chronicles 31, that's it. Second Chronicles 31 talks about this certain collection, and there are other maset collections like it. But for this to work, it's basically a contraction of the phrase. So it still seems kind of tentative until Weinstub brings out these certain examples of seal impressions which have the longer form on it, min maset on it, rather than just memset, the mem mem shin taf on it, but instead mem nun men shin taf. So it's a pretty detailed study. It's a hard thing to explain all in one go, sort of thing. We've got an article going through this on the website, and we link also to Dr. Weinstub's study piece. But it really is a remarkable new study that basically all but proves this as the right reading. Like he bring these few examples of the longer form of this inscription really go to prove his thesis correct, that this is actually the phrase from the maset or from this very specific text or preparation collection. Again, perhaps in advance of Sennacherib's siege, or perhaps some other kind of collection that Hezekiah was doing at the time.
So
So
people can always anything that we're discussing today. It's if you look at the show notes of the program, you'll see the articles linked in there of a greater in-depth discussion of it as well. So people can go back and double check us if they like. So that was number six or seven. Six. You're going to do the next two, number five and four as well.
I'll briefly knock out number five. Perhaps we're jumping the gun a little bit on this, but it is out there in the public domain. It wouldn't be a top 10 list without including Shiloh somewhere on the list. Tell Shiloh and Dr. Stripling, the amazing Dr. Stripling and his Associates of Biblical Research team. They had another year at the site this year, all the more impressive as well in light of all the regional war going on at the moment. So we were able to go to the site and interview Dr. Stripling, another year of amazing discoveries. And then he also did an interview on the ABR channel about this specific find. And what this is in one of the sacrificial dumps at the site, a favisa or a sacrificial ritual dump at the tabernacle site of Shiloh, you have all these animal bones, and within this dump, you also find all these gold pieces, these gold star items, miniature gold star tokens, perhaps some kind of offering, tabernacle offering. So anytime it's gold, this makes top news. But not only that, this year they found a piece with a face engraved on it. So we're still waiting for pictures to come out about this. It is a beautiful looking piece. The pictures of it will be published in due course, as well as the full description of the find. But for now, what we know is that there are these gold token offerings, tabernacle offerings that have been found late Bronze Age from the tabernacle site at Tel Shiloh, one of them being this beautiful piece with a face engraved on the star, gold star item. So we look forward to the eventual publication of that. Now, number four on our list is another seal that has been discovered in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem has a ridiculous amount of seals that have been found. Now, these seals, they're not the animals, that of course they're the seal stamps, the stamps used to seal documents. In the ancient world, even to a modern world, you've got these stamps used to seal envelopes. And so you've got these administrative seals being used in the ancient world, and they'll have the inscriptions of officials or that type of thing on them. From Jerusalem, 35 different seals have been found or had been found until this year. Another one was announced, the discovery of another such seal from the First Temple period, the 36th seal from Jerusalem. To give some perspective, the next highest city in terms of seal stamps is Arad with five. The next one is Lachish with four. Like, Lachish is Judah's second city. It's often called the second city. And from Jerusalem, you have 36 compared to just five and four and less from these other peripheral.
I'll just interrupt you because there's a study that's not on our list, and the reason you know so much of this is because this was just published under your byline along with Professor Yosef Garfinkel. It's published in the Jerusalem Journal for Archaeology. That's put out by Hebrew University. It's called A Corpus of Iron Age II Inscriptions from Jerusalem: The Background for the Writing of Biblical Texts. It's a massive database of all the Iron II inscriptions that have been discovered in one location, all provenanced as well. And so that's why you're up to date on exactly how many have been found in Jerusalem. And then this one comes out, I guess, partway through the process of putting that together.
Right, just before it went to print, this came out, and so we were able to add it, but only as a postscript. So this would be the 36th seal. So it attests numerically alone to the administrative importance of Jerusalem compared to any other city in Judah or Israel or Phoenicia or any of these other Levantine surrounding sites from the southern Levant. So this particular seal, it has the inscription Le-Yehuezer ben Hoshayahu, so belonging to Yehuezer, son of Hoshayahu or Hoshaya. And this dates to the late First Temple period, so just before the Babylonian destruction. And the numeric quantity of these seals, just to one side, there is another interesting angle to this particular seal in that it may even refer to a biblical individual. Some have made this case. I think it's Jeremiah 43. It talks about an individual called Azariah or Azrael ben Hoshayahu or Hoshaya. So the names are a little bit different. The father's names are exactly the same. The initial names are a bit different, but the Hebrew is just flipped, basically. Like, the first half of the name is at the end of one and at the start of the other, and basically means the same thing. So it is more tentative, but based on the similarities there, some have suggested this could be referring to the same individual. So another fantastic find. Anytime you find epigraphic remains, seals, it points to administration. And when it comes to Jerusalem, it's just an unmatched city as far as these finds go quantitatively.
We have another article again online that people can look at this and read more about it. I'm going to take the next two quickly. The number three we've called Compton's Assyrian Camps. This is named after the researcher Stephen Compton, independent researcher. I just met him last month up in Boston. We had a really good discussion about the next piece he's working on. But this one came out this year, and it describes the trail of King Sennacherib, the Assyrian king that came into Judah in the late 8th century and was taking over many, many cities, all of them, except Jerusalem, the fenced cities. He famously conquered and deported a lot of people from Lachish. You talked about before, this being the second city of importance in Judah. And this was preserved in the wall reliefs of Sennacherib up in Nineveh. And people can go and see those wall reliefs at the British Museum in London. It's incredible to see an episode in the Bible, an episode that the Bible describes pictographically by somebody that was there at the time. And this is this incredible discovery in itself. So Stephen Compton comes along, and what he did was overlay with satellite imagery, or not satellite, pictures, I think, from the British period, with the of the topography of the land around Lachish, and then matched it up to the wall reliefs that were in Sennacherib's palace. And what he was able to do was locate the place today of where Sennacherib's encampment was, where all his men were stationed, where a lot of them were stationed. There's a picture or a graphic representation of the camp itself on the Lachish wall reliefs in a circle. And then if you match up the distances to and the direction to the imagery from a plane of the layout of the land today, it's to scale. If you excavate or if you investigate that same location of the same distance from where Lachish is, you will find a circular fort. I would say excavation would be good if some excavation's done. I mean, it's largely been destroyed by farming. This place where the Assyrian camp was, but I think that most people do agree with Compton's research as far as where the Lachish camp was, where Sennacherib's camp was, based on his paper. And he goes on to discuss more of these potential camps, one in Jerusalem. I'd say that the Jerusalem one that he puts forward is probably a little bit more tenuous in my opinion as to where Sennacherib's camp might have been. However, that could be accurate as well. So that was number three. Kudos to him. All right, I'm going to do number two. This refers to the mammoth carbon dating study that was done in Jerusalem, taking 103 carbon samples, short-lived, mostly short-lived carbon samples, olive pits, date seeds. What else did it have? Even some animal remains as well. What it did was take all these samples from different parts of the city of David, mostly off the top of the ridge. The city of David's behind me, and you can see this big, narrow, big strip. That's the city of David. So most of these excavations take place slightly off the top of that ridge where they got these samples from, which is important. But what it showed was a number of key findings. It showed that 20% of the samples they took or they received in those other areas that prove human habitation. These were samples that come from humans being there, and then they ate something or what have you, and it dropped out. 20% of those were dated from the 12th century to the 10th century. So this is showing that Jerusalem, while they didn't find structures necessarily dated to those time periods, there was habitation in the area going far. This is back to Jebusite time, going through into King David's time as well. So that was one of the big announcements from the discovery. Another one was that one of these sites that was excavated where they got a lot of samples from is from the Gavati excavation. I should say also this was a study that was put out by Tel Aviv University, the Antiquities Authority, and the Wiseman Institute. They came together for this. So this excavation in the Gavati area, they call it, is off the top of the ridge in the northwestern side of the city of David. And one of their buildings that they've found, two-story building, Building 100, they call it. Its initial, what they found was in the construction, in the floor, in the plaster, is that they had remains that would date the initial construction of the building to the very late 10th century, early 9th century, based on their own data, is what they would say. And this was sensational because everyone's considered that it was just Jerusalem, was on the eastern hill, this ridge behind me, through the 10th century. And then even people said, no, it wasn't even the 10th century. It was 9th century, 8th century, what have you, when it was first developed. And what this is so showing is that they're already building buildings off the top of the ridge in the very late early 9th, 10th century, just after 30 or 40 years after King David, after King Solomon's time. So if they're building in the valley during the late 10th century, it shows that there were structures on top of the hill further on in the into the guts of the 10th century, which would be Davidic, Solomonic period. So a couple of interesting facets from this remarkable study. And there's more to it as well. And definitely go back and read our article on that.
Okay, Brent, of all 8 billion or so people in the world, you happen to be the very right person to talk about this final discovery. You are the man in connection to this top discovery on our list. And not only that, I think it happens to be behind your head somewhere in that cabinet.
Yeah, it's in that cabinet right there.
This is, of course, the Ophel Electrum Basket Pendant. What on earth is this item?
So this was uncovered in 2012, excavations we were on with Dr. Ilat Mazar, and it's one of the small finds that was discovered in wet sifting, and we kind of put it to the side, and we'll get to that and study it in a later time period. Well, that later time period was late last year, or late in 2023, when we just came across it in the office of Ilat Mazar, and we're like, well, what is this thing? We should find out what it is. And it's this tiny little bit of what we didn't know then was gold, looked gold, but it was confirmed to be electrum, which is part silver, part gold, a bit of copper in there as well. And upon flicking through a book on jewelry from the Iron II period, I could see a lot of parallels to this that were of a very unique Phoenician type of basket pendant that hung from an earring. And so this was kind of amazing because the biblical connections of the Phoenicians to Jerusalem are well attested to in several passages at times in the 10th century. King David got the help of the Phoenicians to build his palace. Solomon gets the help of the Phoenicians to build his palace, his temple. And this indicates a Phoenician presence. The Bible says there were Phoenicians present in Jerusalem in the 10th century. And so now we've got a Phoenician earring showing up in Jerusalem in the 10th century. And so I was able to start doing the research on this. I called in the help of Dr. Amir Golani from the Israel Antiquities Authority to assist. He's the jewelry expert. I'm no jewelry expert. So when you're out of your league, you get somebody that knows what they're talking about to help put together this paper. And he was blown away when he saw this, because this is like one of his babies, you know, this concept of the Phoenician basket pendant and how wherever you have Phoenician colonies along in the westward expansion of Phoenician people to their different trade outposts, that's where you exclusively find these style of earring. And so then to find one in Jerusalem was absolutely phenomenal, because it again testifies to a Phoenician presence in the city. So that's been published now in Hebrew. Hopefully we'll put something out in English soon enough as well, but there's definitely a popular article for that. And so to have our number one find come from a dig that we were involved in and got to publish, certainly a great blessing for us.
And kudos to you for making it happen.
We did it.
Thanks.
We did. Until next year, Chris, thank you very much for all that you add to our institute. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Well, there you have it. Thanks very much, Chris, for being with us today to go through the top 10. And thanks very much for watching. If you do like the program, don't forget to like and subscribe to the video. I'd also say if you like to receive print material of biblical archaeology and archaeological discoveries and history of the land of Israel, we do put out a magazine. This magazine's entitled Let the Stone Speak as well. It comes out 6 times per year. It's about 40 pages. It's in full color. It's absolutely free. We'll send it to you wherever you are in the world. You just have to make sure that you resubscribe every year to ensure that you keep getting it. If you would like to receive the magazine, please go to our website, armstronginstitute.org. You can scroll down and find a place to put in your own address. Or if it's easier, you can email me by writing an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. And put your name and address there, and we'll sign you up, and we'll make sure that you receive the next copy that comes out of Let the Stone Speak.